Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. The first line in Ned Blackhawk's book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History, asks, how can a nation founded on the homelands of dispossessed indigenous people be the world's most exemplary democracy? He goes on to write, this question haunts America as it does other settler nations. Among historians, silence rather than engagement has been the most common response, together with a continued unwillingness to see America's diversity from the vantage point of those most impacted by the expansion of the United States. The most enduring feature of U.S. history is the presence of Native Americans, yet most histories focus on Europeans and their descendants. Indigenous history is essential to the understanding of the evolution of modern America. In The Rediscovery of America, Ned Blackhawk interweaves five centuries of Native and non-Native histories, from Spanish colonial exploration to the rise of Native American self-determination in the late 20th century. All of the chapters focus on the interrelatedness of Native newcomer relations, collectively asking whether there is potential for building an alternative American story that is not trapped in the framework of European discovery and European, quote, greatness. Ned Blackhawk is Western Shoshone. He's professor of history and American studies at Yale University, where he's the faculty coordinator for the Yale Group for the Study of Native America. He won the 2023 Book Award for Nonfiction for The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Ned Blackhawk is also the author of Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West. And we are so happy to have Professor Blackhawk with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's really my pleasure, and thank you for that warm and extended introduction.
Well, I just rewatched your acceptance speech at the National Book Awards, and to think that the judges for the 2023 National Book Awards whittled down 638 nonfiction books to just five finalists and one winner, you. What was that experience like for you?
It was really both overwhelming as well as extremely gratifying. Overwhelming in the sense that I had no idea that my book might be up for such distinguished recognition. It also involved a series of, not quite day-long events, but extended readings and receptions and ceremonial activities that kind of culminated in this moment. So it was very overwhelming to be in a room full of 1,000 people celebrating literacy in New York City. I think I was the only academic title up for this or most of the other awards. And very prominent, like, celebrities and literary figures were there. Oprah Winfrey gave the keynote, and LeVar Burton was the host. So it was just, it was very unfamiliar, given my kind of normative academic daily life. But then it was also very gratifying to obviously be recognized in this extremely celebratory and generous way.
Well, huge congratulations, because it really is an amazing book. I have to say, when I started the book, and this is the first question you ask, I closed it and took a deep breath because it's such an important question. How can a nation founded on the homelands of dispossessed indigenous people be the world's most exemplary democracy? Professor Blackhawk, what a time to have written this book, because the word democracy, I don't think has ever been used, well, at least in our lifetime, I should say, because of Donald Trump. There's so many conversations about democracy. Will we still live in a democracy? Will we become a multiracial democracy? And, I watch all the shows, I read so much, and yet in all these conversations about democracy, Native history is rarely, if ever, mentioned. What are your thoughts about that and this conversation so many people are having right now about U.S. democracy?
I agree with your kind of or I share those experiences and similar kind of concerns that we have kind of created a very deep discourse and broad kind of conversation across generations of American citizens, scholars, historians, policy leaders that celebrates American constitutionalism and liberty and various kind of freedoms in ways that have yet to fully recognize their indebtedness or their kind of mutually constitutive nature with darker forms of human history, indigenous dispossession, violence, settler aggression, and other types of historical subjects that are often not brought into these spaces. And I've been doing this type of academic engagement for quite some time. And so I'm very familiar with the concern that these ideas, these questions, these perspectives just simply don't generally make it into the textbook or the conversation or the newsroom or wherever these conversations are kind of occurring. So that was my experience in graduate school. That was my experience as a junior faculty member. And while I really have valued colleagues and supportive students and administrators here, it's still generally a realm of engagement that is outside of the normative frames of understanding around American democracy, around American law, around American kind of political formation. And so I'm kind of constantly trying to raise these questions and offer some alternative perspectives.
I also appreciate the other questions you ask in your introduction. When and where does the story of America start, and who constitutes its central cast? What are the main subjects or acts of this national drama? Are the English colonies the site of the origins of America? Did those who proclaim themselves we the people ever intend to relinquish their exclusive control? I mean, so many important questions that we should be asking. Why do you think it is that this history, there's so much work still needs to be done to ensure that this history is widely known?
I am an optimist, so I do kind of believe there is a kind of productive possibility towards remedying the oversights that we're so familiar with. And even, I don't know that deeply, the kind of recent California indigenous history, say, of the 21st century so well. But I was in graduate school in California and present in kind of moments of a kind of statewide or indigenous kind of consciousness around the quincentenary and the early 90s. And how far the state has come in recognizing, say, for example, the genocide of California Indians compared to where it was 30, 25 years ago is really quite remarkable. There's still obviously so far left to go and so much more work to be done, but we're basically at a point in kind of American history where we're in a position to at least begin looking more thoroughly at these long ignored, often dark, and exceedingly kind of painful chapters in our nation's past. And so that's kind of part of where the book kind of gestures towards, both in the introduction and towards the end, that there has been now a generation of scholars who have worked to rediscover these parts of American history, and that's where I take the title from, and I recognize kind of inherently that there are others who have really pointed towards these subjects, and the kind of task or challenge for me in this book was trying to bring them all together into a kind of unified form. And we're really across most, if not all, regions of North America beginning to kind of have or are in the middle of having more extended conversations about these subjects. It's still not really yet incorporated into the K-12 educational system very systematically. But I know many of your listeners would be familiar with the California Missions, the fourth grade kind of educational requirement that has long kind of celebrated European settlement and colonization in the region, how that process has gone through multiple reincarnations lately. So there's a kind of growing possibility that I'm always trying to kind of keep to stay mindful of. But it is challenging, given, and I think one of the major challenges is just simply the lack of usable resources or kind of clear, intelligible kind of guides into these landscapes and subject matters. I'm just shocked often at how removed Native nations are from kind of maps and kind of visual kind of cartographies of America. For a long time, reservations weren't on maps of, you know, the AAA offered, you know, to American motorists. So if you can't literally find visible references to these communities, it's understandable that people outside of them don't know much about them.
Today, we're speaking with Ned Blackhawk, who's professor of history and American studies at Yale University. He won the 2023 Book Award for Nonfiction for The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. It's a very incredible book. It's 445 pages of so much important history. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Blackhawk, we'd love to hear from you. We'll talk about what people are taught in schools. What did you learn about Native history in school? Luckily, there are so many amazing books coming out now, documentaries. Unfortunately, Killers of the Flower Moon did not win any Oscars the other night. But more and more people are learning about history because of actors and filmmakers and writers and, you know, people who are demanding a seat at the table to tell these stories. So what are your thoughts about this moment we are in? Also, we just got word yesterday, this is a headline 2 days ago from Berkeleyside. Berkeley will buy Ohlone Shell Mound site, return it to Indigenous Land Trust. The city will transfer the contested parking lot in West Berkeley to the Segorite Land Trust, making it among the first cities in the country to return land to Indigenous people. So the land back movement is getting so much more attention. Of course, Standing Rock was massive. So what are your thoughts on these issues, where we are today and how we got here, and then where we have to go to ensure that this history is centered when we talk about U.S. history? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Can you tell us more about how you got to this place, Professor Blackhawk? You mentioned a bit about what you learned and didn't learn in schools, and I listened to a few of your interviews, and you said for the most part, when it comes to Native history, you were self-trained.
You know, that is partially, yeah, that is largely true. There weren't courses when I was an undergraduate in college. I did, you know, like I mentioned, have the fortune to be in graduate school in California. The UC system, by far, has the most kind of deepest and oldest, collectively, that is, kind of Native studies communities. many of the primary, you know, scholars or the journal, like the American Indian Culture and Research Journal, was at UCLA when I was there in the early 90s. I think it's the center there has celebrated its 50th anniversary. So these are not like unfamiliar subject matters, but when I was in the U.S. history program at UCLA, and I considered joining the Berkeley graduate program beforehand, there were not, at least while I was there, Native American studies graduate level courses are being offered. So I would have to take a class on the American colonial period and study Native American history for my own specialized interests. And I would take a class on the American West and do a research paper or something for one of my research requirements, things like of that nature. So in a sense, I am, you know, I'm not just self-taught, but I had to learn not only in school, but afterwards. And so when I started teaching, at my first job was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, I really had to kind of try to put 500-plus years of post-contact Native American history into a single semester course. And that's when I started realizing there weren't really good textbooks for the subject, and the maps at the time, this is like before the internet, you know, there weren't a lot of visual aids either that I could effectively utilize. I was using like transparencies and old school type of technologies that my students now don't even know what I'm talking about. So that kind of immersion into the field was, you know, challenging in certain ways. But like I mentioned, there have been now at least two generations of Native American historians, both Indian and non, doing this type of work, so that we're not, you know, essentially by ourselves. And even though I might have been one of the few graduate students at UCLA doing this in a very big U.S. history graduate program at the time, or may have been the only Native American historian teaching in the history department, at least at the University of Wisconsin, another very big history community. I knew I had colleagues and friends and peers, essentially, and mentors across the region, across the country, whose work and courses and things inspired and kind of kept animating my own kind of interest. So that's where some of my self-engagement, you might call it, has some of its most formative development. But eventually I started realizing I didn't really know things like American Indian law and policy that well, and I had to kind of learn much more about the American kind of constitutional system, the place of Indians in the Constitution, their exclusions, and like the 14th Amendment and subsequent like Supreme Court rulings that also required me to like self-train in a way that, and a lot of this, or much of it, was done by simply engaging other people's works. And so the book is really, in a certain way, a testimony or testimonial to this generation or two of scholars whose work have been so kind of influential. And I think my colleague, an Ojibwe historian at the University of Minnesota, called it, in fact, that testimony to the transformation of the field of American Indian history that has occurred over the past several decades. Her name is Brenda Child, a very prominent American Indian historian whose work and leadership have been, you know, very instrumental. So there have been obviously many others, countless almost scholars, tribal members, community members, others kind of engaged in these subjects. And I have, you know, in a sense that I've had the fortune to have had the time and energy and kind of wherewithal to kind of try to distill some of this into a single text.
When you were doing the research, and it's extensive research, I mean, just to read some of the chapters, American Genesis, Indians and the Spanish Borderlands, Foreign Policy Formations, California, the Pacific, and the Borderlands, Origin of the Monroe Doctrine, Taking Children and Treaty Lands, Laws and Federal Power During the Reservation Era, what were some of the major surprises for you, given that you did such extensive research here?
Those are three of the chapter titles you mentioned. I believe chapters 1, 8, and 10, I believe. And within each of these chapters, I was like deeply, at times, startled by the level of historical influence, the centrality of indigenous peoples. Essentially, in every of the 12 chapters of this book, I essentially had my central argument confirmed, which is that it is impossible to understand the history of the United States without its indigenous populations. And that's true in, obviously, the pre-contact world, when there aren't any European populations here. It's true throughout the colonial era, when Native peoples dominated the interior portions of North America well into the 19th century. It's true throughout the 19th century, when the United States is expanding west. It's a very weak, ineffective federal government that is trying to rule or kind of govern places like California or the Rocky West, and indigenous peoples are central to that process of settlement and formation. It's true throughout the late 19th century into the Progressive Era and into the early 20th century, when Indians are kind of culturally and symbolically representative of a certain form of American national identity that is so resonant, it's identifiable in art and children's literature and museums and the emergent academic disciplines that we now call things like history and anthropology and other scholarly fields. Indians essentially are at the heart of, you know, just numerous chapters of American historical formation. It's hardest to make that argument perhaps for the 20th century. But if we look at our recent past and see Indian gaming and the growing kind of sovereignty of tribes, you mentioned the, you know, land back initiatives of recent years, we are living through a moment of indigenous reckoning that very few kind of policy analysts or non-tribal members sometimes have the capacity to even understand or name. And so this book's really trying to point out and kind of historicize some of those developments. And so each chapter is kind of full of those types of confirmations and revelations. I could give some specific examples, but I don't know if that would be as helpful as kind of just talking more broadly about the general strokes.
We can definitely go into examples in the second part of the show. We're almost at a break, but I just want to read from your book about what you're just describing there. Building a new theory of American history is no small undertaking. It will take years and will require the labor of generations of contributors. It will need new themes, new geographies, new chronologies, and new ideas that better explain the course of American history. It's a simultaneous challenge and opportunity, one that falls particularly hard on tribal members who continue to bear the burdens of explaining indigenous experiences, history, and policies to non-native peoples. Just reading this, Professor Blackhawk, makes me think about the young natives out there who are doing such amazing work and are demanding a seat at the table. I just wonder, what has it been like for you putting this book out to speak with young Native Americans about this? As you say, it's no small undertaking. It's going to take years of work, but there are amazing people out there doing this important work.
There are, and I'm really fortunate to have worked in a few institutional settings that are full of particularly active and motivated students, and I have, you know, worked in other forums with high school and or other tribal community members, but largely my career has been for 25 years now in the university setting and at Madison, where I taught, and now in Yale, working with 18 to 22 year olds has really been the kind of primary form of kind of pedagogical engagement that I've been engaged in. So I don't know if you noticed this, but I, in fact, dedicated the book both to my wife, Maggie, but also to the students here in what we call, what is known as our Native American Cultural Center, whose kind of energy and kind of passion have really kind of changed the kind of course of our own institutional setting. And they're amazing and surprising and full of kind of energy and insight. And so I agree that, you know, when I conclude my, you know, lecture class every semester, I tell the students that these are their challenges, essentially, that, you know, these are these unsolved kind of misunderstandings or kind of what we might call in academic parlance kind of historiographical challenges or erasures are challenges that are now open to them to remedy and reform. And and while most don't consider careers in the academy itself, many are carrying their kind of commitments to reforming American history or American injustices or American misunderstandings around Native peoples into other realms. And it's really quite remarkable, but there's still so much work and need to be done, as I know you know. So I think we can't lose sight of the challenges within Indian country, even though we are clearly in a much more kind of optimistic and or at least cautiously optimistic place.
Right. That's a good way to put it, cautiously optimistic. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with Ned Blackhawk, who is Western Shoshone. He's professor of history and American studies at Yale University. He won the 2023 Book Award for Nonfiction for The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He writes, Indigenous history is essential to understanding the evolution of modern America. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Ned Blackhawk, professor of history and American studies at Yale University, where he's the faculty coordinator for the Yale Group for the Study of Native America. He won the 2023 Book Award for Nonfiction for The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Blackhawk, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What did you learn about Native history in school? And what do you think about this moment we are in with so many books coming out, documentaries, films about Native history? It's such an amazing and important time. Also, a lot of uncertainty, of course. We'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we get to calls, Professor Blackhawk, I just wanted to ask you a question about your students at Yale. Of course, everyone's different, but what has your experience been like? How much do your students know about Native history, and what are they most curious about in your classes?
This would apply to the Indian and non-Indian students that I was, whom I were describing earlier. Generally speaking, very few undergraduates have any understanding of American history before 1800. And I think it's still a legacy of the U.S. AP history structure that has overwhelmingly focused on the post-independence and even the post-Civil War era. And so I'm just routinely shocked at or reminded by this kind of startling observation. And so much of this book, part one, which is six substantive chapters, is about the history of the United States before the constitutional, before the Republic's constitutional form. And it draws upon, you know, just extensive bodies of scholarship that have made Native people central to the early American past in ways that would have been inconceivable 25 or 30 years ago. And one of the really interesting, here we are into the kind of the more the details of the subject, one of the more interesting oversights that students are really shocked when they hear about is that the American Revolution, according to a very prominent military historian of the colonial era at UC Boulder named Fred Anderson, the American Revolution is less important to the course of the 18th century than is the war that preceded it in North America, known as the Seven Years' War. And so chapter 4 and 5 of this book are very heavily about this period from the 1740s, 50s, and 60s, when the largest colony in North America, controlled by France, goes to war with the British Empire. And Native peoples are central to the course of, to the outbreak of that war, its course, as well as its conclusion. And it's in the concluding moments of that war, when the when England obtains essentially the French claims to North America entirely at the Treaty of Paris in January or February of 1763. All of a sudden, England has more than doubled its territorial claims in North America, while acquiring, because England had fought Florida, Spanish forces as well, who were French allies, England also claims several Spanish possessions across the Western Hemisphere, from the Falkland Islands to what were then known as East and West Florida. So you can now walk, essentially, from the Floridian Panhandle all the way to the Hudson's Bay, which is essentially the entire stretch of North America, and stay within the realm of this newly constituted British realm known as British North America. And so, while my students are completely like utterly uninformed, as we all are essentially in America, about these histories before the revolution's outbreak. But they're central to the course and understanding of the revolution and thus the nation as a whole. And one of the kind of shocking kind of revelations that I kind of stumbled upon or kind of came upon from reading all these other people's work and studies and so forth is that the end of the war, known as 7 Years' War, is in many ways the beginning of what becomes the Revolutionary War. Because backcountry settlers anticipate, now that the French are expelled, the French are Catholic, they're, you know, intermarried and diplomatically military allied with Indians. They're really the kind of primary antagonists in the consciousness of British settlers in North American society. They fear Indians, but they also fear the French because the French are trading and supplying and allying essentially with indigenous allies across what is now known as the history of New France. So the expulsion of France does not, however, lead to a kind of commensurate decline in indigenous authority. And the British are essentially dragged back to the battlefield unwillingly through a subsequent war known as Pontiac's War, when indigenous confederacies across the Great Lakes region form and destroy many of the forts that the British have inherited from the French, and essentially begin reminding the British imperialists that they lack authority in these interior realms that they've now claimed from France and the Treaty of Paris. So what do the British do? They make a declaration or a proclamation line in late 1763 that prohibits settlers from moving west. They start diplomatically trading and allying and supplying indigenous communities across the Trans-Appalachian frontier. And this aggrieves and upsets British settlers who are anticipating a much more bountiful future for themselves in the interior lands of the former French colony, particularly along the headwaters of the Ohio River. And so it's not incoincidental that, you know, the anti-indigenous values and ideologies that some of us might be familiar with from the Revolutionary era start getting hardened and kind of articulated and particularly kind of advanced in this moment. And they make their way all the way into the Declaration of Independence that many of us may know, or many of your readers or listeners may know, culminates. It's like the crescendo of the Declaration is a claim that the King of England has incited, quote, merciless Indian savages to, quote, attack our frontier communities. Mm-hmm. And so those terms, savage and frontier, are the legacies of this conflict, essentially, that's been brewing and then exploding across the 1760s after the 7 Years' War has ended. And so I make a strong claim that the origins of the American Revolution have to kind of understand the indigenous animosities, essentially, of the settler communities that are forming across the Appalachian Mountains. And these communities are violent, they're aggressive, they're defiant, and they start, you know, interdicting British trade, they start marauding British forts, they start essentially self-governing. And there's a scholar whose work I draw upon who calls them frontier rebels. And so I say that they're not thieves, they're not pillaging British supply lines, these are rebels. They're trying to essentially revolutionize British Indian policy. And somehow they've been left out of the conventional narrative about the origins of the revolution that has focused so overwhelmingly on seaports and merchant and kind of Virginia gentry elites, when forms of violence, forms of self-rule, forms of individual kind of community settlement formations are occurring across this time and across many of these interior regions. So that's one of the kind of particular subject matters that very few people encounter conventionally in their educational system, and it's just one of, you know, countless other examples in which Native Americans and the centrality of Indians to American history have been excised from our kind of familiar understandings of our nation's past.
Well, if you want to learn more detail about what Professor Blackhawk is talking about, I hope you can pick up a copy of his book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. It's such an extensive book. We're going to talk about the maps in just a minute. Laurel couldn't stay on the line. Sorry about that, Laurel. Laurel wanted to say, I was shocked and embarrassed to learn a few weeks ago that Native Americans weren't even citizens until 1924. I'm so glad you brought this up, Laurel, because I was actually going to ask listeners, did you know this? Professor Blackhawk, I'm sure a lot of people have no idea. You write, this happened by which time the federal government had seized hundreds of millions of acres of land from Native nations in more than 300 treaties. Tens of thousands of Native peoples were killed by settler militias and U.S. armed forces during the Civil War era, and government-sponsored campaigns of child removal from reservation communities resulted in 40% of Indian children being forcibly separated from their families and taken to boarding schools by 1928. So another fact here, Professor Blackhawk, that Native people were not U.S. citizens until 1924.
That's correct. And basically, it's hard to convey what this kind of means in an everyday way, because it's not conventionally intelligible in a world in which our understandings of American democracy, rights, and freedoms are so individuated. Because demographically, Native Americans were not significant components of the American body politic in the early decades of the 20th century. They'd suffered so many generations of deprivation, confinement, warfare, and these policies of child removal and land alienation were generally designed to assimilate them or bring them forcibly into the body politic of the United States, not as tribal members, but as American citizens. And so citizenship was potentially obtainable for Native American male property owners if they essentially disavowed their commitments to their tribal communities and adopted these fragmented portions of their tribe's reservations known as allotments beginning in the late 19th and throughout the 20th century. And so if you were a Native American reservation community member in 1880 and you were the head of a household, you could become eligible to consensually obtain title to 80 or perhaps 160 acres of your former reservation homelands. And if you held it in good standing for 25 years and turned it into a productive agricultural potential ranch or farm, you could then not only gain title to it, which is the kind of Jeffersonian vision of agrarian democracy that it's the heart of so many 19th century debates, you would also potentially gain the right to vote and thus citizenship. So that was the kind of ideal that was kind of dangled in front of tribal communities. But historically speaking, Native Americans have not generally desired that sole form of American legal and political participation. And many have fought instead for tribal community rights, for the protection of self-governing authorities, for the enforcement of those treaties that you referenced, for the protection that the federal government made to tribal communities, a series of promises that became broken throughout much of the 19th and throughout the 20th century. And so Chapter 11, which is kind of most squarely about this era, identifies how Native intellectuals and political advocates organized to advance this kind of dual strategy of trying to find ways of participating within the body politic of the United States as American citizens, but doing so in a way that essentially allowed them to be citizens also within their own tribal communities. And this form of essential dual citizenship is in many ways pioneered by Native peoples who are essentially participating in multiple forms of sovereign political practice throughout much of the 20th century, and it's disturbing many American policymakers who eventually, after the Second World War, decide that the tribe shouldn't be sovereign anymore. And the federal government begins this policy that's in Chapter 12 of this book called Termination, where they begin essentially abrogating any federal protection for tribal communities and turning tribes over to the states for essentially state governance and county kind of hospital and educational affairs. And so all of a sudden tribes no longer have a federal protectorate that they'd been working with for often generations, if not centuries, and are forced to deal with tribal affairs within a state system that is very adverse to tribal sovereignty. And so that launches one of the kind of concluding sections of this book, which I call the Modern American Indian Sovereignty Movement, in which tribal communities begin fighting collectively to get their sovereign authority recognized and to reverse this practice of termination, which eventually Richard Nixon will renounce in an address to the nation in 1970, inaugurating what is now the era known as American Indian self-determination.
Well, thank you for that comment, Laurel. I think it's so important that people talk about this, that a couple weeks ago you didn't even know that Native people were not citizens until 1924. Thank you for that. Today we're speaking with Professor Ned Blackhawk, author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. In our remaining 5 minutes, Professor Blackhawk, I think a lot about why it is that Native issues and people are missing from, you know, everything from wayside exhibits, for example. I mean, many of them sound like they were written in 1950. I mean, it's just so basic. You read about the captain of the ship who made it to shore and they got along with the Native people who lived here. Now move along and read more about the captain of the ship. I mean, that's so common today. To, you know, we receive press releases about housing, poverty, you name it, who votes, and Native people are often missing from those press releases. And I think about what it's going to take to change this. And I remember asking one of our Native guests who was adopted, why do you think this is? And she goes, because people think we want all of the land back. She goes, it's that simple. And so I just wonder what your thoughts are. I mean, to hold a mirror up, as you say, again, this question, how can a nation founded on the homelands of dispossessed indigenous people be the world's most exemplary democracy? What do you think it's going to take? I mean, it is changing slowly, but what do you think it's going to take to ensure that when we talk about democracy, Native people are no longer missing from that discussion or Native history?
I mentioned this kind of dual emphasis, or this dual parallel set of objectives that tribal leaders in the early 20th century initiated or envisioned. It's a similar vision that animates late 20th century Native American political history as well. And it's one that I think the more we hear about it, the more we encounter it, the more we learn, the more we kind of work in partnership, often across tribal or across Indian, non-Indian divides, we'll come to realize that this is, in fact, one of the great actual strengths of American democracy. Ironically, even though it was founded in these kind of incredibly extractive, dispossessive, and tragic ways, that over time, Native peoples have activated a latent founding principle, which is in a legal sense known as the doctrine of retained tribal sovereignty, which is why Indians were not officially citizens of the Republic, why they entered treaties, why the federal government exclusively has the jurisdiction to interact with tribal communities under the Commerce Clause and a series of court rulings, most notably known as the Marshall Trilogy. There is a doctrine, there is a legal tradition, there is a history of indigenous advocacy that have made these principles into what they are now. And if we can see them collectively as a nation, as principles that we should all essentially understand and learn and value, then we can begin normalizing them and not excluding them. And so in Canada, they're going through similar types of transformations, but they have a very different legal history and tradition. But there's a kind of common refrain across kind of Canadian political circles as you may know, in which people all claim to be part of what they called, we are all treaty people, which means essentially we're all participants in a process of treaty making that has yielded our contemporary political geography. And if we can see ourselves in that similar form, we can all say we're all members of American society in which tribal nations have retained sovereign authority over their lands, over their members, and over those who travel through them. So that state government, so that municipal government, so that American citizens value and understand these jurisdictional realms. Unfortunately, in part because of the way the American legal system is organized, Indian law hasn't been taught at the leading law schools in the country. So many of our jurists who sit on the Supreme Court or in federal court systems don't know these subject matters. And it's been a little ironic that Justice Gorsuch has become the real champion of Indian sovereignty in recent years, in part because of his time as a judge in the West. And this is a kind of subject matter that is not often conventionally intelligible through our kind of two-party understandings of American politics. Because many Western senators, many Western leaders have long understood the necessity of understanding and working in partnership with tribal communities in ways that have bred non-ideological types of polarities. And so John McCain or Barry Goldwater, to a limited extent, even Nixon himself, you know, Westerners have kind of been at the heart of the formation of more kind of expansive doctrines of American Indian governance than have Eastern, often elite administrations who often want to assimilate Indians in a sense. So that's a little bit of a simplicity of 20th century American political history, but that's kind of my response to that very important but complicated question.
Yeah, well, thank you. And also just to think about what life was like pre-contact. I mean, the map that you have in this book, it's really amazing just to look at all of the tribal names. I mean, the California map, you can barely put all the names on the map because there are so many. So it's just, I think about this a lot, like what life was like before contact and these complex societies and communities that, you know, most of us don't really know much about. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to think about. My ancestors and your ancestors. Professor Blackhawk, it's been great to have you. We barely scratched the surface on your book, so we would love to have you back. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to have had the time with you, and I should conclude by saying I don't consider this work at all to be comprehensive and hopefully just the beginning of a much longer conversation to come.
Yes, thank you so much. Ned Blackhawk is Western Shoshone and Professor of History and American Studies at Yale. He won the 2023 Book Award for Nonfiction for the Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.